Thank you for listening to WOLA's Latin America Today. I'm Adam Isaacson, the Senior Associate for Regional Security Policy here at the Washington Office on Latin America. It's Thursday, August 7th, 2014. And I'm just back from a two-day visit to the U.S.-Mexico border, specifically the part of the border where McAllen, Texas meets Reynosa, Mexico, about an hour's drive from the Gulf of Mexico. This is South Texas. It's the heart of a zone that has seen more than 42,000 Central American children arrive unaccompanied across the border just since October. Many more of the children have come with parents, like this Honduran woman we met, who traveled more than 1,200 miles with two children while pregnant with a third. She gave birth just as she crossed the border. She says the father's still in Honduras. Many of the unaccompanied children from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras arriving in Texas, as well as some of the families, say that if they're returned home, their lives will be in danger because of community-level violence where they've come from. Their countries have the world's highest homicide rates, so many of them are being temporarily allowed to stay in the United States until an immigration judge can hear their case. Now, when you look at a map, geographically, South Texas is the closest point to Central America. This, as a result, is the only part of the U.S.-Mexico border that's seeing a big increase in migration. Everywhere else along the U.S.-Mexico border is calm. Migrant arrivals are near 40-year lows. In South Texas, even though it's slowed down a lot since July, the unaccompanied minor crisis overwhelmed U.S. officials. Ever since it began spiking, the number of children arriving began spiking sharply upwards in February. But the unaccompanied minor situation, we found, is only one of a few humanitarian concerns. We heard about others, too, in the South Texas border zone.
Here's the border. Want a picture? One, two. All right.
I traveled with Representative Jim McGovern of Massachusetts. He's a congressman with whom WOLA has worked for many years because of his very strong interest in human rights in Latin America. We started late Sunday afternoon by walking across the Hidalgo International Bridge over the Rio Grande River into the city of Reynosa, Mexico.
Buenas tardes. Buenas tardes.
We paid a visit to Senda de Vida, an evangelical church-run migrant shelter located next to the Rio Grande by the border crossing. In fact, it's so close to the United States that our conversation was occasionally drowned out by U.S. border agents' helicopters. Nearly every Mexican border town has at least one shelter like Senda de Vida. So do many towns along the routes that Central American migrants most commonly take while getting across Mexico. Most of the shelters are run by religious groups. They offer migrants a temporary safe haven, meals, and the ability to bathe and sleep before they move on again. Senda de Vida was very full on Sunday night. We spoke to about 200 people. Many were Central Americans who'd fled their home countries. Most said they were escaping violence and threats, often from street gangs.
More than anything,
weekly,
there is 10 to 20 dead people a week.
Solo en su en el barrio de donde viene usted.
Just in the neighborhood where she comes from, 10 to 20 dead a week.
A woman from El Salvador said that one of the gangs responsible for the 10 to 20 people killed every week in her neighborhood were calling her constantly to extort large amounts of money. She fled. A woman from Honduras left after her husband beat her badly, and she said he's in prison. A neighbor was planning to go north to the United States, and she begged him to take her along. She only had enough money to bring one of her three children with her, her youngest, to pay the smuggler. On the way, in the city of Tampico, several hours south of the U.S.-Mexico border, she and 18 other migrants were kidnapped. Her captors tried to extract ransom money from her aunt in the United States. Her group was rescued by Mexican Marines, who then left them at the migrant shelter in Tampico. Now she's preparing to cross the river. Central American migrants' trip across Mexico is dangerous, whether they go by road or by the cargo trains that cross Mexican territory. A Honduran man made his way from the southern border to the town of Coatzacoalcos in the state of Veracruz.
So I had to go all around every time there was a roadblock. Yeah, como docenas, no? I had to go off the road and go around all the Mexican roadblocks. Because that's dangerous. Because there's a lot of people who do come going around the checkpoints. So, when you go that way, there's gangs just waiting for you, armed with machetes and guns. And they take your money when you're off in the wilderness there around there, so you're always going to be there. And if you don't give them the money, they'll kill you. They'll kill you. They'll leave you dead on the roadside. So you have to speak clearly to them and say, no, I don't have money. If I had it, I'd give you everything, but I don't have it. And if not, they'll kill you.
There in Coatzacoalcos, he boarded the cargo trains that go near Mexico City and then go on to the U.S. border at four different locations. Another Central American man told of the dangers of traveling on these trains.
It's dangerous on the train because little small groups with machetes come by. And if you're just one, two, three friends in a group, they threaten you with the machetes. And they take your money. And if you have anything of value, like a necklace or a bracelet, they'll take it from you. And if you have money on you, sometimes they come all, they're all drugged up. Sometimes, just if you don't have money, they get angry and they throw you off the train. Sometimes the money that some good people given you, you end up having to give it to them. They rob you of all your money. And of course, then there's a problem here that they don't let you cross.
Many others of the guests staying at the Senda de Vida shelter were men who had been deported from the United States recently. Some of them, before being deported, had lived in the United States for years or decades. They'd started families here. A common story, heard it a few times in variations, is that one day, a day like any other, a police car pulled over their vehicle. The police then shared their information with immigration officials, and that was it. These men haven't seen their children since.
They're just doing this over and over with so many people, like throwing them over here and leaving them separate from their kids. What I'm trying to get back, I don't know how, but I'm not going to leave my kids alone. I don't want to get back there somehow. While I'm still alive, my struggle is going to be for my kids, and I'm worried about my kids.
Now, U.S. officials often say the sort of one of the best ways to deter or dissuade a migrant from trying to come to the United States is to make clear through regular systematic deportation that you will be sent back. But the deportees who have been separated from their families, usually U.S. citizen children, they're not at all being deterred from trying to cross again. It's almost impossible to hold back someone who simply wants to be reunited with his spouse or his children. And the risks that they're willing to take include risks to their own security. This is Reynosa, a town that's largely controlled by organized crime, quite frankly, mainly by the Gulf Cartel, but often contested with a lot of violence by the Zetas. Nothing illegal gets across the border here without organized crime giving permission in exchange for payment. Eddie Canales of the South Texas Human Rights Center, you'll meet him in a few minutes, he was with us, and he asked the migrants what would happen if they were to leave the shelter and even just go take a look at the riverbank, look at the United States on the other side. They laughed at that.
How many of you have gone to the river and tried to
figure out what's going on
in the river?
What do you see when you look at the river? Bandits come with pistols and try to rob money from you when you go down to the river.
Yeah.
Wow.
In fact, people are stuck, for all intents and purposes, on Senda de Vida's one-acre compound. It's surrounded by a high wall and barbed wire. Thieves on the outside know that migrants carry money. They also know that they cannot go to the police for fear of being deported. And organized criminals threaten migrants who may think of crossing without their permission. It's better just to stay inside, explains Hector Silva, the shelter's director.
We have to, a rule is that we don't go outside. Because many of them do go out, and then we don't see them again.
Entonces realmente tiene que pasar toda la vida aquí adentro.
Sí, they got to spend their whole lives here inside.
Hector, the shelter's director, even explained that the shelter itself is not necessarily a safe haven. Armed men on other occasions have even tried to force their way in, and Hector has simply had to confront them nonviolently. Just to punctuate what a big deal security is, just listen here how the crowd reacted when Congressman McGovern made a very modest proposal. This was not an applause line.
But surely there has to be more that can be done to ensure the security of people here.
Pero seguramente se puede hacer, por ejemplo, mucho más para garantizar la seguridad de ustedes aquí. Yeah.
And you know, with all the...
feel unsafe.
After our visit to the Senda de Vida shelter, it was nighttime in Reynosa. We crossed back into McAllen and had dinner with Eduardo, or Eddie Canales, of the South Texas Human Rights Center, which is based in Corpus Christi. You heard him ask that question a couple minutes ago. Eddie does most of his work about an hour's drive north of the border, where the U.S. Border Patrol keeps two permanent checkpoints on the highways that connect the border zone with Houston and San Antonio. The biggest mission of Eddie's center is to put out barrels, big barrels full of jugs of water, on the ranch land that surrounds these checkpoints. That's because after the deserts of Arizona, this area, not on the border but an hour north of the border, is the second deadliest place in America for migrants. Here's Eddie Canales.
In 50 different ranches, at least one person has died in 50 different ranches just in Brooks County alone.
Wow. Well, Brooks County, when we were talking about 80 remains per year, the last year years
was,
now.
Last year was 87.
Wow. It's up to what, 44 in Brooks County?
Today there's 44 in Brooks County alone, 51 in the RGV sector.
Migrants know that they can't go through the Border Patrol checkpoint. They have to get out of whatever vehicle has been taking them on the highway and walk around it in the surrounding countryside. But even that 5 to 10 mile walk can be treacherous, especially if your smuggler has been holding you in a safe house for the past few days, maybe not giving you enough water to drink, so you're already a little tired and dehydrated. The terrain is dry, flat, covered by sagebrush, not much visibility, and no landmarks like mountains to guide you. It's very easy to go find yourself going endlessly in circles in the 90 to 100 degree heat. And several dozen migrants die each year on the ranches of Brooks County, Texas, not far from the highways and the checkpoints. Eddie tries to convince the ranchers, some of whose properties are as large as 50,000 acres, to let him leave the water stations on their property and to allow he and his team to visit regularly to refill them. Eddie says he needs to do so about once per week because migrants take all the water jugs pretty quickly. But getting ranchers to agree requires some diplomacy.
The major difference between what happens in Arizona or California or in Texas is that this is all private ranches. So I have to appeal to the goodwill, to the humanitarian interests of the ranch community.
Now, you can support the work of Eddie Canales and the South Texas Human Rights Center simply by visiting southtexashumanrights.org and clicking on Make a Donation, and they could use it. Despite the expanded effort to get water onto the ranches, far too many migrants don't make it. And then, dealing with the dead is a whole other challenge in Brooks County, which is not a border county but is one of the poorest counties in Texas. Handling remains properly is expensive.
If you were to talk to the chief deputy of Brooks County, he said, show me the money. Show me the... Because
right.
He hasn't seen anything.
Right.
And he's 75 miles from the border, not a contiguous border county.
Right.
Having all the ramifications and effects and consequences of border policy.
All because of a checkpoint.
Because of the checkpoint. And not receiving one federal cent for the processing of graves, the retrieval of the bodies, all that, and it's all also relates in terms of what state law and state law makes it. It's an unfunded mandate, you know, because officials encountering unidentified human remains in your jurisdiction, you are instructed to issue an autopsy and a DNA.
Right.
Every county does not have a medical examiner. So Brooks County contracts at a roughly, probably the one up total being anywhere from $25,000 to $3,000 per person.
Now, that's a huge cost for Brooks County, again, one of the poorest counties in Texas. The number of dead this year in the county is a bit lower than the last two. They're finding fewer remains, but now we are in summer, and numbers may go up in the triple-digit heat. Brooks County will have to pay the bill of as much as $3,000 to properly handle each body that gets found on the ranches and try to identify as many as they can. Still, though, there's no fix in sight to get the county the resources that it needs. Now, on Monday morning, we visited the U.S. Border Security agencies working in the McAllen area. I don't have any audio to share for that part of the trip because we were not allowed to bring cameras or recording devices, but I can tell you it was a little like visiting a town trying to recover after a big storm passed through. Now, the big wave of the big spike of unaccompanied Central American children, that wave has ebbed for now. Officials say that starting at the beginning of July, the number of new kids arriving has dropped by more than two-thirds. We don't know exactly why. Some of it is seasonal patterns. Some of it might be the nature of the false rumors about special permits for children that seem to have been circulating around Central America. Some of it may have to do with all the media attention that the crisis has gotten. And some may have to do with U.S. authorities being quicker about deporting entire family units in the past week or two. But there's no guarantee that arrivals of unaccompanied children won't go up again between now and early next year. And even now, the number of kids arriving is still about the same pace as 2013, which at the time was a record year. People from Customs and Border Protection working at the Hidalgo border crossing told us how in April through June, their small facility, really just a single suite of offices, was full of kids who had to stay for several days each time because there was simply nowhere else to send them. These are just the kids who actually showed up at border crossings. The admissibility building there is smaller than WOLA, but it was so full that every night the floor was completely covered with cots. Officers were buying snacks, coloring books, and other things with their own money. Then we went to the Border Patrol's processing center, which is in the same building as the Rio Grande Valley Sector's headquarters in McAllen. This is the busiest station headquarters in the busiest Border Patrol sector in the whole country. The McAllen Station alone, one of nine stations in the Rio Grande Valley sector, has apprehended 95,000 migrants since October. About half of them have been either unaccompanied children or families with children. They get taken to the McAllen facility to be processed. The processing facility in the back of the building is a place that I'm going to remember for a long time. Imagine a room about half the size of a tennis court. This room is filled with computers and biometric equipment. Border Patrol agents are at these computers entering people's information into databases, all the people that they have in their custody, putting their information into databases as fast as they can. In one area in the room, apprehended migrants are also sitting at computers. They're talking by Skype to Border Patrol agents who are in less busy sectors like El Paso or San Diego. And those agents are putting their information into a database. That's how they're dealing with the rush. Now, this room you're imagining happens to be surrounded on three sides by holding cells. I didn't count them. There are at least 12. Altogether, these cells were holding a total of at least 100 people, probably way closer to 200. Each of these cells has a concrete floor, cinder block walls, fluorescent lighting. There's a shoulder-high partition in back that hides a toilet. Each one was so full, you know, usually about 20 kids or adults, that there is no place left to sit on the benches or floors. About half of them are filled, half of the holding cells were filled with kids, separated by age and gender, or with families with their kids. They haven't been processed yet. They've just been caught, so they're unbathed. They're looking either very bored or very freaked out. Each holding cell has a locked glass door and a big glass window, and the people inside have nothing to do, so many of the kids especially, are just looking through the windows all day into the room full of computers and agents. You smile and wave, they smile and wave back, which is somehow even sadder than if they just sort of look scared. After months of working in that room, the Border Patrol agents in that room they seem to be used to working with dozens of kids staring and watching them on all three sides all day long. I don't know how they managed to do it. I was there for maybe 15 minutes, and it's going to be with me for a while. Border Patrol was very clear that what we saw there is nothing compared to what it was like before. The rooms were even fuller out on their loading dock in the back. For instance, when DHS, Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson visited in May, there were 400 people, they said, in a space about the size of a full tennis court. There were still some people out there. One was believed to be contagious, so he was separated from the others by police tape wound around trash cans. Now, if a child is Mexican, and if Border Patrol agents don't believe that he or she will be endangered if returned to Mexico, they can deport that child as quickly as possible, and he or she becomes the responsibility of Mexican child welfare authorities. If the child's from a country that doesn't share a border with the United States, then a 2008 anti-child trafficking law sends their case to an immigration judge. While their case is decided, the law says that detaining the unaccompanied child should be avoided if possible, so they're often freed to family members living in the United States, or they're kept in a shelter run by the Department of Health and Human Services. Now, finding relatives or shelter placement can take a while sometimes, and it was badly backlogged a month or two ago. So Border Patrol quickly built a new facility in McAllen that can temporarily house about 1,000 people. It opened on July 19th. Now, everyone at this center is doing the absolute best they can. They're quite admirable. Let me underline that. The best they can to provide what the government calls wraparound social services to these kids and families. There's medical care, there's showers, toys and books for the kids, hot meals brought in. The scene is far less disturbing than the processing room with the holding tanks at the Border Patrol station, where people usually don't stay more than a day at the most nowadays. I've never seen in this facility, I've never seen so many boxes of crayons and coloring books, but the site is still one, face it, of children penned into cages made of chain link fence. They spend a day or two, sometimes more, there awaiting placement somewhere else. Again, the staff here doing their absolute heroic best, but they're doing it with very few resources and within an often absurdly rigid bureaucracy. Now, if a Central American family claims that they would be in danger if returned, and if Border Patrol finds that claim to be credible, then that family is also given a date to appear before an immigration judge and freed. What was happening in McAllen is that Border Patrol was simply leaving them at the local bus station after freeing them. This sight of disoriented families wondering what to do next shocked many citizens of McAllen and the greater Rio Grande Valley. They moved quickly to pick up the slack. Dozens of volunteers stop and applaud every time a new vanload of recently released migrants arrives at Catholic Charities' big operation at the Sacred Heart Church in McAllen. Catholic Charities has been taking families from the bus station and giving them a place to clean up, sleep, and eat ever since just after the crisis really began in the spring. In a way, Sacred Heart is a mirror image of the Senda de Vida shelter across the river in Reynosa. It's where some selfless people are trying to carve out, at least for a while, a safe, calm place for tired, traumatized migrants and their young kids. Families get hot meals, baby formula, and diapers. Donations of used clothing, neatly sorted by size and gender, are stacked way high on tables throughout the room. Families can use bed space and ventilated tents that the city has installed in the parking lot. And they get something else that Border Patrol wasn't providing until very recently, a shower. The city of McAllen has paid for 8 temporary showers so that families can clean up, sometimes for the first time, in a week or two. Here's Sister Norma Pimentel, who heads Catholic Charities operation in the Rio Grande Valley.
To provide showers was the best thing that we had. First, we would just wipe these and the restrooms clean up as much as we can. But as soon as the city put us 8 showers outside, the transformation was phenomenal. The families and moms cleaned up and just walking in, having your clothes, the children dancing and feeling like a child again. It was just a wonderful to see, you know. That we were able to provide that for them and make them feel human again, you know. So it was fantastic to see that.
Sister Norma has put together a very efficient operation very quickly. The Sacred Heart facility has filled an enormous gap that the federal and Texas state governments could not or would not fill. It's very easy for local residents or even visitors from around the country to just show up and sign in to volunteer. Most of all, though, the Catholic Charities operation needs money, and you can donate by visiting the web address. I made a shortcut. It's a long web address. bit.ly/immigrantrelief, all one word. Asked what Americans should know about the people coming through the Sacred Heart facility, Sister Norma reminds us that these families are not much different than them.
You know, they need to know that the greater majority of the families that we're seeing are good families, families, home people like ourselves, mom and dad, or mom and their kids, women and children that are searching for an opportunity to have a justify this. That's all they want. These are moms that need protection. They need care. That's all they are.
Sister Norma adds that they need a better immigration policy with clearer rules for people who need protection.
Obviously, we have to have some immigration policy that addresses this so that people don't have to come through this dangerous journeys. And that if somebody has a cause to request asylum, that they could do it in a more safer way.
We at WOLA emphatically second that. We want to see a quick end to the South Texas border zone's several humanitarian crises. But we know that these crises are just the northern end of a longer emergency that begins in the violence-torn regions of Central America, passes through the dangerous migration route through Mexico, and is fed by institutional corruption all the way until it reaches the Rio Grande Valley. This is a big phenomenon that neither Washington nor the governments of Mexico and Central America are doing enough to confront. So the tragedy that South Texas witnessed this spring could recur any time. And that's it for now. Thank you for listening, and please do keep listening to WOLA's Latin America Today. Please remember to support our work if you can, but also do what you can to support Catholic Charities of the Rio Grande Valley, bit.ly/immigrantrelief, and the South Texas Human Rights Center at southtexashumanrights.org. Click on Donate. Thank you, and hasta pronto.